Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. I hope you've enjoyed the interviews I've done over the past couple weeks. I've got some great interviews in store for you upcoming. I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with these fascinating scholars about birds, bridges, airports, and everything in between. Today, we're going to start a new series on the history of Chinese Americans in California. It's a fascinating subject with many interesting twists and turns. Obviously, a dark history as well. I hope to explore both the hardships of racism and exclusion, but also the beauty of survival, family, organization, and the incredible diversities of cultures that Chinese immigrants brought with them to California. So let's get started. Chinese in California have nearly as long a history as the European migrants that arrived throughout the period of the Gold Rush. The Bear Flag Revolt, the Gold Rush explosion, and the arrival of Chinese immigrants all occurred around the same time in the history of the West. Like many immigrant groups, public perception had ups and downs. Gritted teeth inclusion for economic necessity and racist exclusion, cultural immersion, and ethnic rejection all intermix to create this complicated history. Like many complex stories, we can choose a number of ways to talk about this. We can choose to tell a dark story, highlighting injustices, hardships, heinous crimes committed against the Chinese immigrants. We will do plenty of this. We also need to tell stories of survival, how Chinese immigrants leveraged their grit and resourcefulness to build deeply impactful and fulfilling lives in a new land, like many of the immigrant communities have done across the history of the United States. We'll do a lot of this as well. To only tell the dark side of history skates across casual tales of heroism and resistance and turns a people group into a passive receptacle for crimes committed against them. To only tell the stories of survival and resistance paints over the history and injustices, invalidating the experience and trauma suffered by many people, which often continues to reverberate today in how people talk, interact, and avoid certain situations and environments. We always need to tell both stories. Some people would tell you that one is more important. They are always wrong. It's always both. Which admittedly is hard to hear for some in a deeply polarized world. Striking that balance, which I will aspire to, is challenging and will likely frustrate those on the fringes, but we need to do it to capture as much of the range of what happened as possible. We're going to start with the Chinese immigrants arriving in California around 1848 in time for the Gold Rush. When you discuss immigration patterns, it's always important to discuss push and pull factors. Your vantage point often dictates your spotlight. If you're in the U.S., you might tend to look at the pull factors, the promise of gold, wealth, and opportunity. If you're in China, you might look at the push factors, including but not limited to high taxes after the Opium Wars, challenges with subsistence farming, ecological disasters like floods and droughts, and many more. We're going to begin this episode by discussing the push factors. Beginning in 1847, there was a rapid influx of Chinese immigrants to the United States. This was at least 2 years before the massive immigration for the Gold Rush. This indicates that there were push factors that were influencing immigration decisions before the pull factors accelerated that same pattern of immigration. The first push factor was the Opium Wars. The Opium Wars were a conflict between the British Empire and China. Britain imported a lot of goods from China, including tea, silk, porcelain, and more. This led to a trade imbalance, which is when one country imports more than it exports. This can weaken currency and lead to a loss of domestic jobs as local industry competes with foreign companies. The British solution to this was to begin smuggling opium into China. This shifted the imbalance in the other direction. As drug addiction depleted China's silver reserves, the emperor fought back and tried to destroy the British opium reserves. In response, Britain sent the navy, and thus began the first opium war in China. The first war lasted from 1839 to 1842 and ended in the defeat of the Chinese. This began a period often referred to as the Century of Humiliation. The specific consequences of the end of the First Opium War was that the Chinese were coerced into opening up 5 ports to trade with Britain. British subjects were also granted land rights in the country. And finally, the Chinese were forced to cede Hong Kong to British control. The consequence of most concern to us here is the element of foreign competition, which was allowed in China. British businesses could now directly compete with Chinese enterprises, creating a result for many Chinese that was economically disastrous. This dearth of economic security led wandering eyes to gaze across the Pacific for unknown opportunities and potentially escape the constricting noose of British control. Beyond economic, political, and military push factors, environmental catastrophe was always a possibility in the river deltas of China. Throughout China's history, floods wreaked havoc. There are many reasons for flooding, including silt buildup, changing river directions, deforestation, intense monsoon seasons, amongst many other variables. The Chinese government set itself the task of managing rivers, primarily the Yellow and the Yangtze. However, in times of war, river and flood maintenance often took a back seat to military concerns. In the 1840s and 1850s, there were floods along the Pearl River Delta. This was in the Guangdong province, which is the origin of many immigrants to California in the 1850s and 60s. There were also Yangtze River floods that occurred during this time. Refugees from this part of China migrated to the Guangdong province, where they joined the throngs of those escaping to America. News of the gold rush spread around the world. Immigrants came from almost anywhere they had news. China was amongst those. We won't spend too much time in this section, because we've covered it in other places, but initially, this was the first major pull factor drawing the boats across the Pacific to the rocky coast of California. In addition to immigrants from the Guangdong province, there were also many immigrants from across China who migrated to coastal ports to get on ships to come to California. Oftentimes, immigrants from these areas of China would travel in groups, sometimes referred to as self-help groups. These groups served multiple purposes, but primary among those was to leverage their limited knowledge of language and customs. They would often immigrate all with the same surname. Many of them borrowed money for the trip, as the voyage cost more than they could afford, which they had to repay over time. Sometimes the money was loaned through families, and other times it was loaned through agencies. There were also some groups who wanted to bring Chinese over as quasi-indentured servants with labor contracts. However, this didn't work that well, as there were limited enforcement mechanisms and represents a minority of the immigrants to California. Most Chinese who arrived in California entered through the port of San Francisco. There is a question of status in arriving in California. At that point in the history of the United States, legal status was tied to race. Only 2 races were recognized legally, black and white, and Chinese were not considered to fall into either category. Some Chinese immigrants may have passed as white, such that they were able to attain citizenship status, but most were not, which left them in a precarious legal category. Not being citizens prevented them from participating both through the ballot box and the government building. The term used for this group was aliens ineligible for citizenship, a kind of permanent limbo, which meant that they could easily be taken advantage of by nefarious actors. One example of this kind of legalized abuse emerged in court cases around mining disputes. Given their lack of status, it was determined that Chinese people could not testify against whites in court. Without those legal protections, all that was left was to avoid conflict entirely. The solution was to adopt a posture of subservience and avoidance, to absorb the blows of verbal and physical abuse, knowing that retaliation would translate into additional abuse, if not worse. Since they were not able to secure American citizenship, many Chinese retained their country of origin citizenship status. However, like many immigrant groups today, they paid taxes and contributed to the economy so much more than any costs that the country might have shouldered. Moreover, like many immigrant groups to the United States, Chinese immigrants to California sent remittances back home to help family ameliorate their difficult circumstances. Beyond a desire to work and improve their lives, the other thing that Chinese immigrants brought to California was a distinct culture. That was balanced with a desire to fit into society to avoid confrontations with the surrounding white communities. For example, in San Francisco, the Chinese wanted to seem like good citizens and accordingly attended public functions like religious meetings, public funerals, as well as civic events. At the same time, they retained important aspects of their culture, like the celebration of Chinese Lunar New Year, for example. Soon after arrival, Chinese began publishing their own newspapers in their own language, and then civic and fraternal institutions were established. These institutions are often referred to, in San Francisco, as the Six Companies. They were mutual aid organizations. Given that many immigrants were landless peasants without safety nets and a steady supply of resources, when illness or injury came, Chinese Americans needed support. This was long before government filled these gaps. These organizations served a few roles in that capacity. First, they helped Chinese immigrants to arrive and return to China. They were a kind of transportation and immigration support service. They also provided support for the sick and hungry. Immigrants would arrive off boats hoping for opportunity. Sometimes opportunities were not readily clear upon arrival, and time was needed to build that capacity. If you got sick in this interstitial time, before finding financial security, typically, family would serve as the first line of defense, followed by charity. Given the racist dimensions of California at this time, there was distrust on both sides. They also provided legal aid if Chinese immigrants got in trouble with the law. These groups, to summarize, worked as a kind of centripetal force for the Chinese community as a whole, a center in which the surrounding community of newly arrived immigrants relied upon. Like many groups, initial organizations were connected to clans, regions, or linguistic affiliations. But over time, as past connections to the homeland dissipated, they came to represent the Chinese community more broadly. Like many organizations, the Six Companies were run by wealthy and influential immigrants who were able to bring resources with them. There was an element of paternalism that came with this kind of control, though. This paternalistic approach was common in 19th century China. It had its origins in Confucian ideals, which emphasized hierarchy, order, moral authority, and the reciprocal obligations of the paternal figure to his followers and vice versa. This paternalism was not just for families, but also applied to community organizations like guilds, Civica's host. This paternalism was not just for families, though. It also applied to community organizations like guilds, civic associations, and religious institutions. Leaders acted like fathers in a caring manner, and subordinates were expected to be subservient in exchange for the leader's sacrifices. Originally, these six companies were all under one heading of the Kong Chow Company, which provided all of the services, but eventually, by 1868, they divided into six separate organizations: the Samyup Company, the Siyup Company, the Ninyun Company, the Yungwo Company, and the Hapwo, and the Hip Cat. Next time, we're going to discuss in more detail the roles of these six companies before expanding out of San Francisco to the broader issues facing Chinese immigrants across California. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. Thank you.